dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the War of Ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. A man whose intelligence, in every sense of the word, I've prized for quite some time is our first guest. He is John Rossomondo. These days, he is the senior counterterrorism analyst at the tremendously important Investigative Project on Terrorism. He is a journalist of some renown, in fact, a prize-winning managing editor at the Philadelphia Bulletin, one of his previous incarnations. He's always a welcome guest here. We're glad to have him. John, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks, Frank, for having me on. I appreciate your interest in these matters.
Well, they are very much of interest, particularly, John, some of the things that you've been reporting on lately with respect to a country that is, I guess still considered by some to be an ally. We've written a book published some time ago by the Center for Security Policy Press called Turkey, Ally No More. And your reporting suggests why that is so. Let's talk a little bit about specifically what Recep Tayyip Erdogan, the president of Turkey, has been doing to support terrorism that should make it obvious he's not playing for our team. That's for sure.
Well, all you have to do is look at the most recent Treasury Department press release from OFAC.
That's the Office of Foreign Asset Control.
It named several Hamas figures who Erdogan has allowed to use the Turkish soil to do fundraising and to do banking without any problems.
That would be money laundering, I think, is another term for it, would it not?
Yes, money laundering. Doing money laundering on Turkish soil to benefit the Kassam Brigades. Not only that, Erdogan has a shadowy private military company called Sadat Defense, run by his top civilian military advisor, retired Brigadier General Adnan Tenreverdi, that has been involved in support in training Hamas, according to Israeli sources. And not only that, they've been fingered in training jihadis from Al-Qaeda and ISIS in Syria.
I want to make sure that we cover a bit what he's doing that is supportive of Sharia supremacist operations inside our own country, as well as those overseas. Talk to me about the Muslim Brotherhood and the now very active strategic alliance between it and Erdogan operating out of places like the Diyanet Center, the largest mosque on the East Coast in Lanham, Maryland, that the Turks funded and founded.
Well, the Turkish Ministry of Religious Affairs, a.k.a. the Diyanet, has become a way that Erdogan projects his power out in numerous countries, especially here in the United States. Just last week, when you had the U.N., General Assembly and Erdogan spoke. Prior to that, a group called the Turkish American National Steering Committee, that includes a guy by the name of Halil Mutlu, who is Erdogan's cousin, had a powwow together with Nihat Awad and a bunch of U.S. Muslim Brotherhood leaders in which they praised Erdogan. You had one individual, Siraj Wahaj, who's a noted person on the
jihadist fundraising circuit
in the U.S., who said that he hoped that Turkey would become the centralized leader of global Islam.
The caliphate.
Exactly.
Erdogan's ambition is to do that as well. Hey, so talk to us a little bit about the U.S. Council of Muslim Organizations. What is that about, and how does that fit into what Erdogan and the Brotherhood are doing at the moment?
Well, it's an umbrella group that coordinates the actions of the various Brotherhood-linked and Jamaat Islami-linked Islamist groups in the United States. And its Secretary General, Osama Jamal, is very close to Erdogan. He's a very strong supporter of Erdogan. And every time Erdogan or any Turkish dignitary shows up, you can expect to find him, along with other board members, such as Nihat Awad of CARE.
That's the Council on American Islamic Relations, one of the most prominent Muslim Brotherhood fronts in the United States.
So we find that they're very close. I mean, they look to Turkey for their inspiration. You have a guy by the name of Sam Momesh, who's a longtime Muslim American Society activist, Darul Hijra Islamic Center, who says that Erdogan's Turkey is a continuation of the Ottoman Caliphate. So that's where they're looking at.
This is not good for us, needless to say, that a sovereign nation with whom we are nominally allied is actively enabling a fifth column in our own country. And it's one of the reasons why I'm so keen to see the Muslim Brotherhood designated as a terrorist organization that it is. And I appreciate the work that you do that helps showcase this sort of threat, John Rossomondo. Let me ask you about, speaking of CARE, an individual that you've recently written about who is their communications director, I believe it is, Abbas Barzegar. Tell us about him and what he's been up to that, again, reinforces this point that these people are up to no good and should be treated as, well, I think, enemies within.
Actually, Frank, he's their research director. He wrote the Islamophobia report that targets are your donors, my organization's donors, just about anybody who cares about opposing them. He made several pro-IHH humanitarian relief statements. IHH is a Turkish charity that has supported Al-Qaeda, ISIS. Turkish prosecutors and police found that they were smuggling weapons and other supplies to Al-Qaeda, Jabhat al-Nusra in 2013.
Yeah, that was before Erdogan took over the place, as he has, of course, done since.
He was still president.
Prime minister, I think, at the time.
Yeah, but IHH has a long history of being close to Turkey's intelligence agency, the MIT. And the MIT has been controlled by Erdogan's political party, the AKP.
This is really a powerful indictment, I think, John Rossomondo, and one of the reasons we value so much your reporting at the Investigative Project on Terrorism is that you connect a lot of these dots, and we need to have them connected in order to understand that Turkey is indeed an ally no more and should be treated as such. Thank you, John, for your time today and for the great work you do. I hope you'll keep it up, and I know you will come back to us. In the meantime, thank you. Next up, we will speak with Captain James Fennell about developments in China that are very threatening as well. That and more, straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. It is a special delight to say that we are joined by a man whose service to our country in uniform, and that he continues to provide now that he's no longer in the United States Navy, is both exemplary and deeply appreciated by all of us who are concerned most especially about the rising threat from communist China. His name is Captain James Fennell. He retired from the Navy in 2015, capping a 30-year career as a naval intelligence officer, specializing really on Indo-Asian Pacific security affairs, and especially on the Chinese Navy. He finished up his tour of duty as the Assistant Chief of Staff for Intelligence for the 7th Fleet, and these days is working with the Geneva Center for Security Policy, not to be confused with the Center for Security Policy in Washington. But he is always welcome here, and I'm very glad to catch up with him in the aftermath of the 70th anniversary celebration, such as it is, of the founding of the People's Republic of China. Captain Fennell, good to have you back with us, sir. Welcome aboard.
Thanks, Frank. Appreciate the time and the opportunity. Thanks.
So what was your takeaway, Jim, from the parade in Tiananmen Square and the remarks of the dictator for life of China, Xi Jinping?
Frank, I think, as I've said to some folks in my Red Star Rising blog, that this just should be a wake-up call for the United States, that we have a truly dedicated superpower that's gunning for the United States. And what we saw on display on Tuesday in Tiananmen Square, you know, were things that could reach out and touch regular American citizens. And I just don't think we appreciated that before as a nation. And what we saw on Tuesday with the things like the DF-41 or the DF-17 hypersonic missile, the newest, latest version of their bomber, the H-6N, that can deliver maybe the DF-17 and these siloed missiles like the DF-5. I mean, China was telling us we are now a mortal threat to the United States. That was a message that I took, and I think more Americans should see it that way.
Now, you've just kind of listed the sort of headliners of a parade that was chock-a-block with missiles and drones and aircraft and unmanned submarines and all kind of things that are clearly threats. And I think it's unmistakably designed to attack Americans, either in our homeland or on our naval vessels or in the Pacific region and perhaps beyond. Jim, the President of China, Xi Jinping, also spoke rather directly about the sort of role that he envisions China playing in the future as the world's dominant power, did he not? How does that fit into what we saw on display?
Yes, I mean, these displays of these weapons weren't just to say that they're going to have this power to attack America, but it was also a signal, which was to say we're going to control a new world system. And we, China, will be responsible for running it. Like America, they accuse America of running the world system for the last 70, 80 years since the end of World War II, and the British, during the British Empire, running the world. They believe it's their right to run the world system. And so they're very open about their form of government, which is a single party, and that the party does no wrong. And so therefore, they're able to do things that democracies can't get done because they have a single party and everybody is looking out for the good of the people. And so they're going to implement this good of the people from Beijing around the world. And so these military tools that we saw go hand in hand with the other forms of manipulation that they're building, like the Belt and Road Initiative or their social credit system and all the artificial intelligence and facial recognition technologies that's being exported around the world and being institutionalized in Latin America, Africa, now into Europe, and soon to be in America.
Good of the people is a euphemism, of course, for forcing the people to bend to the will of the party. And that's just generally not been very good for the people, particularly of China, nor will it be. I think you're right, Jim, if this is exported through the Belt and Road Initiative or through other means more broadly. Let me ask you about maybe inside baseball development here in the United States, Jim, but I know you follow these things very closely. In terms of this threat and how it's being perceived by official Washington, there's a new sheriff in town, I guess you might say. A new deputy assistant secretary of defense has been designated. Well, first of all, the position has been established, deputy assistant secretary of defense for China, filled by Chad Sbrogia. Tell us about him. Tell us about the significance you attach to this reorganization in the Defense Department's Office of the Secretary of Defense.
Yeah, I've known Chad and worked with Chad in my time in Hawaii. He was part of the strategic focus group. He's a retired Marine officer, longtime experience with China, was in the defense attaché office in Beijing, and a known quantity regarding realistic appraisals of China. So I'm very happy that Chad was selected by Randy Shriver and the department. The idea of separating out an Assistant Secretary of Defense for China was something that I was aware of early in the year before it was announced, and I concurred with the decision because for so long we've had in the DOD one desk officer responsible for both China policy and Taiwan policy. And what you saw was that Taiwan policy was many times held hostage by concerns over not offending the PRC and these kinds of things and policy issues. And so now you're separating this out and you're allowing the DOD and Randy Shriver and his team to build alliances, build better policy relationships with Taiwan without having it being changed or manipulated through the U.S.-China relationship lens only. And so I see this as a positive for the United States, and I'm very happy that we're moving towards institutionalizing changes that will help us better confront China's aggression.
That is heartening, especially your assessment of the individual who's going to be playing this important role. Speaking of Randy Shriver, he is, of course, the Assistant Secretary of Defense for East Asia. He's on his way to China, I believe, very shortly. And in a recent comment caught my eye in anticipation of this trip. He said something about the importance of military-to-military exchanges with the Chinese. I think you've taken a dim view of those exchanges, Jim Fennell, particularly as an intelligence officer. Talk a little bit about their advisability, and especially if we are now coming to grips with the fact that the Chinese are our enemies, should we persist in this practice that has, it seems, been a windfall for China through their access to sensitive information on our side and not so much coming the other way?
Yes, Frank. I've been on the record, both in speeches and in writing, about the danger of so much engagement. And I had the opportunity to speak with Randy and others in this last year, and I won't, you know, reveal the details of those conversations, but I'm convinced that Randy and the department have recognized the danger of this. And so I think if you compare the number of mil-to-mil engagements in 2018 versus 2017 versus 2016, I believe the numbers are lower. We'd have to check that, but that's my understanding, is that we've had less. So I think that we're on the right track. We have to be very careful about it. I think at the operational and tactical level, we should have no engagement with the PRC mil-to-mil-wise, because it turns over technology. Like, I'm looking right now at a picture of this new Chinese underwater drone, the SHU-001. I mean, these are technologies that were clearly stolen from the United States, and part of it comes from their engagements with us and talking with us. We don't need to do that. But it may be at the DASVI level and above, there is some opportunity to have hard-nosed talks with the Chinese, and I think Randy's the kind of person that can help deal with that. But when we do it, it has to be measurable success. We have to go into the talk and say, here's what we want, you know, these tangible items on a list. And if we don't get them, then we're not going to have more talks. And I hope that's where we're headed.
Me too. Hey, Jim, quickly, let me ask you about one other thing. Again, you've understood very well the nature of the Chinese Communist Party, and I think probably have been aware of one of the really serious problems that we've been elevating as the Committee on the Present Danger China, which I'm very pleased you're a founding member, namely the degree to which the Chinese have been getting access to immense amounts of money in our own and other Western capital markets. And there's a new development that's just come to light as a result in part of our most recent threat briefing of the Committee on the Present Danger China, which can be seen at presentdangerchina.org. And that is that your retirement money and mine and that of other government personnel, both serving presently and retired, military and civilian, is going to be used in 2020, going forward, all other things being equal, to help underwrite some of those very Chinese companies that are helping the Chinese Communist Party become more and more of a threat to us and to their own people and to others around the world. Can you speak as a distinguished member of the now retired military community of the United States about how you feel about that prospect?
Frank, I think it's an outrage, and there's not a good reason for it at all, because every dime that the U.S. retirees put into the PRC, a large percentage of that money goes to these weapons we saw on Tuesday. These are weapons that are pointed at us. And so while I can't control as an American citizen the free market, what Apple or Boeing choose to do in the PRC, I am an American and I have a voice just like you, and we should be speaking out and saying that we don't want our money, our retirement money, being used to be invested in the PRC.
Amen. Jim, we have to leave it at that for the moment. Thank you so much. Come back to us again very soon if you would, Jim.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
We're back with the distinct pleasure of being able to welcome to our microphones a dear friend as well as a valued colleague, one of the great historians and, well, savants, let me just say, about the Soviet Union now doing business as the Russian Federation under Vladimir Putin. His name is Dr. Stephen Blank. These days, he is a senior fellow at the American Foreign Policy Council, but he has a long and very distinguished record of pedagogy, notably in the National Security Studies Program at the U.S. Army War College. He is the author of over 1,000 articles and some 15 books that he's either published in his own right or edited. He is an extraordinary national resource on matters involving, as I say, what the Kremlin is up to at the moment, what it has done in the past, and what it might do in the future. It's great to have him with us. Dr. Blank, welcome back.
Thank you for having me again, Frank.
Much to talk with you about, Dr. Blank. I wanted to put this in the context of a sort of Russo-Chinese alliance that seems to be developing. But before we get into sort of what all of that portends, maybe you could say a word or two about this massive military exercise that the Russians and Chinese undertook in the past month and what it says to us about the nature of this relationship.
The exercise is called Center, which is the Russian word for center. It's part of the regular cycle of exercises on an annual basis that culminates in September with this largest of all of these exercises. And every year they rotate the direction of them. So, for example, in 2018, it was east. In 2017, it was west. 2019, it's the center, which is Central Russia, Central Asia, and so on. First of all, these are exercises for large-scale war, and that probably includes, as have all these others in the past, nuclear contingencies and the exercise and rehearsal of nuclear operations. Second, this one is particularly unique in that it is a multilateral alliance, not a multilateral exercise. Not only did the Chinese participate, but the Indians and Pakistanis and Mongolians did. Now, obviously, there's a political message here. Apart from rehearsing Russian and Chinese and other forces in large-scale contingencies, not anti-terrorism, as they say, this is an attempt to show that Russia has many allies, particularly in Asia, and that it doesn't really need the United States and it has support in Asia. Now, most of this is propaganda. India is an independent actor to somewhat lesser degree, but still Pakistan is as well. India and Pakistan are not foregoing their U.S. ties. But the Russo-Chinese alliance, and I do think it's an alliance, clearly is doing very well, not only in military affairs, but also in economics and diplomacy. So this is an attempt to show that the alliance with China, as well as the partnership or affinity or whatever word you like with Asian players like Pakistan and India, and also to show Russian military capability, and of course, as is the case in any exercise, to show the military what needs to be worked on.
Let me ask you to elaborate on a couple of key points there, Dr. Blank. One is, when you say a mass war gaming Give us a sense of the scale of this thing. It's not only remarkable for the number of countries that were involved, but the number of personnel, pieces of military hardware, planes, even ships that were involved as well.
Hundreds of thousands of men. Now, if you realize that the Russian army, the ground forces, is a total of probably 300,000 men on active duty, or something around that figure, you get a sense of the scale and scope of this. And one of the purposes of these exercises, one which has been visible for the last 10 years, is to test the mobilization capabilities of the Russian state and the ability to mobilize troops very quickly at a theater or to a theater which is going to be either under attack or the basis for an offensive. So these are also attempts to show, and they have a longstanding basis in Russian history, the ability of the state to mobilize lots and lots of people and get them to the theater very quickly. If you remember the words of Nathan Bedford Forrest, that you know victory goes to the general who gets there fustest with the mostest, as he said. I mean, the idea by Russia is to be able to mobilize lots of troops for the initial phase of the war and win quickly. And this is a rehearsal for that.
Okay. That's the conventional piece, primarily. Talk about this strategic nuclear attack. Who was the target of that, as best we can tell?
As best we can tell, it's Europe and the United States. There has been less reporting about the nuclear dimension of Center, primarily because, the word indicates, it takes place in central Russia, and there's no major military power on Russia's flanks. There are other security issues like terrorism or insurgency there. But if you look at the totality of these exercises, West 2017 or East 2018, you see a nuclear scenario which either occurs in the exercise or coincident with it, which is clearly aimed at the United States and or its allies, usually in Europe.
And simulating thermonuclear attacks against the United States, it seems to me, should be considered to be an unfriendly thing to be doing. And the fact that the Russians and Chinese are seemingly preparing to collaborate in such an attack is particularly ominous, which gets me to the next question to you, Dr. Stephen Blank. What is exactly the nature of this partnership between the Russians and the Chinese at the moment, as you see it? Is it a full-on strategic alliance? Is it just sort of a modus vivendi between people who ultimately may be squaring off at each other, but now see a common enemy or something in between?
There's a great debate among both Russian analysts and Chinese analysts concerning this. The minority view, which is the one I hold, is that it's an alliance. Now, it's not a formal alliance. There is no, as we say, de jure piece of paper that says they are allies and that commits one side or the other to attack anybody if the other side is attacked. But in practice, I see an alliance. Other people see varying degrees of partnership. The Russians and Chinese describe this as a comprehensive strategic partnership, and they add on all kinds of adjectives, as the case may be, to that moniker. And the effort there, I think, is to conceal what's really going on. But we have an intensive record of intergovernmental coordination on civil and economic and political and military issues. 3,600 Chinese students have studied in Russian military academies. Russia is selling arms to China. They are doing joint exercises of both conventional and, I should say, missile defense and air defense operations. They clearly have overlapping ideas about the nature of contemporary warfare, although the vocabulary and traditions are of course, quite different. Their political relationship is excellent. They are aligned on major diplomatic issues. I would argue that, again, this is a minority view, but there's plenty of evidence for it, that they are actively cooperating together, for example, in Central Asia. They certainly are cooperating together on Korea against us. Russia refuses to sign a peace treaty with Japan that would formally end the Russo-Japanese aspect of World War II. I think that's because of the Chinese presence to a considerable degree. Russia has announced that if we build intermediate-range missiles in Asia, they will too. Now, those missiles are there to defend against North Korea and China, not not Russia. Nevertheless, it's clear that Russia will come to what effectively amounts to the defense of China here, at least in a political sense. So we also see cooperation now in information warfare and some other operations in Europe. This is beginning to occur. We've seen exercises in the Baltic Sea, in the Mediterranean Sea, now on land. Then we've seen them in the Sea of Japan, in the East Asian Sea, South China Sea. This is a pretty systematic affair, and I'm not even going into the economics and a lot of the politics of it. So I think your listeners can get a sense that this is really serious stuff.
Hmm. It is serious stuff. And as we look at what they're doing, Stephen Blank, you've obviously given thought to what we should be doing in response to it, both to deter what these characters have in mind and perhaps to counter the effects of their, alliance, for want of a better term. What would you recommend?
The first thing you have to do is strengthen your alliances. And to be honest here, we're doing a pretty bad job. I mean, there's no way to around this. But President Trump's attacks on the European Union are extremely harmful in Europe, and all the evidence indicates that. Europe has enough problems as it is without the United States sniping at it. We need to strengthen both NATO and European integration, because that is the greatest asset America has in terms of both defense of its interests and defense of its values. Even if you think interests and values are synonymous, and I do to a certain degree, the European Union is an exemplar of liberal democracy in this sense. So I mean, it espouses our interests and values, whatever the trade differences may be. They're minor compared to the benefits we get out of it. Second, the same is true in Asia. Right now, for example, there is a terrible dispute between South Korea and Japan, going back to Japanese occupation of Korea before World War II. We fell asleep at the switch and let this thing get completely out of control, to the point where South Korea was doing exercises around islands that they dispute with Japan. This can't be allowed to happen. Even as the president goes off to talk to Kim Jong-un, and there are working groups that are about to meet as we are speaking on Korea, it is necessary at all times and is a fundamental principle of American foreign policy in general and in East Asia that the alliance with Japan and South Korea must be absolutely solid, and we have to manage that consolidation.
Yeah, it is not solid at the moment, and I think one might fault people on this side of the pond, if you call it that. The Big Lake, maybe, is a better way of putting the Pacific. But clearly, what Moon Jae-in is up to is very destructive of this alliance as well, and this is something we need attention to. We are hard out of time, my friend. We have to go. Thank you for joining us today, Stephen Blank, and come back to us again soon. Keep up, I know you will, the great work you do with the American Foreign Policy Council. God bless you, my friend.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. It's a delight to say we are joined by one of my favorite guests. He is Todd Bensman. He's a man of many parts, having served, both as a journalist and as an extraordinary figure in the Texas Department of Public Safety's Intelligence and Counterterrorism Division. Background that has informed his work now with an indispensable organization, the Center for Immigration Studies, where he is a senior national security fellow. He is also a contributor in other outlets as a writing fellow to the Middle East Forum, as a contributor to The Federalist, and also as a political columnist for Town Hall. A man of many parts, a Renaissance man in a way. I'm very pleased to have him with us. Welcome back, Todd. Good to have you.
Yeah, thanks for having me. Thanks for that intro.
Well, heartfelt and well-deserved. Let's talk a bit about some of the work that you have been doing. I think a really important service to our country in researching, analyzing, and calling to our attention, specifically the nature of the threat emanating from terrorist organizations, specifically what I call Sharia supremacist ones, south of our border that are now getting into this country and taking advantage of the opportunity that I am afraid may translate into acts of terrorism here. Just give us a 30,000-foot level assessment of how that looks to you.
Sure. Well, we have to remember that there is a steady state migration flow from countries of the Middle East and Muslim majority nations of Africa, you know, such as Somalia, and also from South Asia, Afghanistan, Pakistan, moving migrants into South America and then through Central America, Mexico, and then Texas, California, and Arizona, right over the border. Most of them are asylum seekers. Most of them show up with no identification and no verifiable way for us to be able to determine their basic identity, let alone their background and histories in their home countries, which have terrorist organizations operating in them. So that flow of migration from those countries to our border is regarded as a significant and serious threat by itself.
As it should be, for heaven's sakes. And yet, Todd, we're usually hear from the people who are insistent that we must keep our borders open and welcome all migrants that there's really not much evidence of terrorism or people who might be willing to perpetrate it, taking advantage of our porous border. That is, of course, at odds with your own assessment, I take it.
Yeah. So there are, I would say, dozens of cases in which American authorities and the security net that we have deployed in Latin America and at our own border have actually identified and apprehended people who are on, for example, U.S. terrorism watch lists. Before they arrive, they had been placed on those watch lists. My estimation is about 20 of those a year. And so if we are arguing that there's never been a terrorist act on U.S. soil from that border, that we have been lucky so far and that we've apprehended enough that we have probably interdicted plots and things that would have happened. That's not to say that we have apprehended all of them, because in 2011, there was a Somali who came through the Mexico-California border after smuggling through Brazil and Latin America, Mexico, who then went on to cross the Canadian border north, and then he conducted a double vehicle ramming attack carrying an ISIS flag, wounding five people, severely hurting five people, including a police officer who he stabbed after he ran him over, luckily survived. His name is Sharif, Abdullahi Sharif, and Sharif actually is on trial right now. His trial started this week on five counts of attempted murder and aggravated assault. They did not charge him with terrorism because I guess it's because it's Canada, and they don't have terrorism in Canada, or they don't want anybody to know there's terrorism in Canada. But in any case, that case is being covered by Canadian newspapers, mostly local, but not a single word of that in the U.S., which contributes to our lack of general knowledge that things like this happen.
Yeah. You know, Todd, I know we spend most of our time talking with you and others at the Center for Immigration Studies and other outfits who concern themselves with border security about the southern border, but you're so right to call attention to the northern one. A colleague of ours, David Harris, a former member of the Intelligence Services of Canada, has been quoted recently warning that, you know, a very significant possibility of terrorist attack emanating from or through, I should say, Canada is present at the moment, and we are ignoring it at our extreme peril. So it's not just what you're seeing in Latin America. It's also the possibility of the porous border along our north, and the fact that the Canadians may be ignoring this terrorist threat to some extent, certainly are welcoming with open arms an awful lot of migrants coming there who, as you say, may have malign intent. Let me ask you about one of the other characters that we've recently been hearing about from Bangladesh, a fellow by the name of Milan Mia. You've written about his role as a smuggler from of people from South Asia, specifically from Bangladesh. How serious a problem does his example suggest we have emanating from that region, where we know Sharia supremacism is very much on the march?
Oh, yeah. Well, let me just give you a quick 30,000 foot. The U.S. Homeland Security enterprise as a whole, particularly ICE, Homeland Security investigations, and our military intelligence have focused much of their effort on countering the threat from the South, this jihadist infiltration threat from the South, by targeting the smuggling organizations that make it possible for these incredible journeys to happen. One of the targets has been a network of Bangladeshi smugglers who have been bringing in thousands of Bangladeshis to the southern border. Bangladeshis are probably one of the most common special interest alien categories that we see at the border these days. There are literally thousands over the past 5 years have made it over.
And by special interest, that's a technical term for those that have to be particularly interested in.
It's government lexicon for these kind of migrants. And so they arrested Milan in Mexico, but he was part of a bigger case where they arrested a second one in Monterey, Bangladeshi, and they worked together on just the Mexico leg. But those two individuals were part of an even more expansive network that was operating and probably still is in Brazil, which is a major staging point where they enter and then they make their way up. Very well organized, very oiled machine for bringing Bangladeshis in, and they knocked it out. It'll probably take a while before they can reconstitute themselves, but by the act of disrupting those networks, we as a Homeland Security concern are able to slow roll the numbers that come in. It really does kind of impact things because of the distances. But that's what happened is, they knocked out a couple of the key smugglers who were bringing in all those thousands of Bangladeshis. And we really don't want Bangladeshis coming over the border in those numbers because we have no way to vet them or screen them at all before they come in.
Now, this is, of course, the problem that you at CIS have been documenting so doggedly, and that is that these are the ones we know about. And these are the ones that we've apprehended. These are the ones that we've brought to trial. These are the ones that we have at least somehow, somewhere, to some extent, in the system, as it were. But that is, as you've indicated, Todd Bensman, a fraction of the numbers that are actually making their way into this country, about whom we know probably nothing. This is deeply worrying. And again, your work, both that you provided in the past and that you're providing these days at CIS, is deeply appreciated, Todd Bensman. And I hope that you'll not only keep it up, but come back to us again very soon with further updates. I hope the rest of you will do the same again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.